Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
There are cities that are slums. There are informal settlements where safety, welcome, the ability to simply be a female and get out of the house might be more important than seeing the stars.
Do you ever change your route because the pathway in front of you is a bit too dark for your liking? We might not think about it very often, but high-quality urban lighting is a determinant factor in how we experience our cities. But it's not just about safety. Having our streets properly lit up also allows us to take advantage of the nighttime and better use our cities when the sun goes down. So join us over the next 30 minutes as we unpack the history, importance, and the future of street lighting. That's all ahead, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Following the murder of Sarah Everard in London this March, a young woman who was walking home after dinner when she was attacked, the UK's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, declared that his government would more than double funding for neighbourhood safety measures. Among several seemingly low-bar efforts to drive out violence against women, such as CCTV expansion, the government also pledged funds to improve street lighting. While this is obviously a very small gesture, we wanted to use it as an opportunity to look at street lighting and how improvements can change the way our cities function and make them feel like better places to live in. So it's only fitting that we start by looking at the history of lighting in our cities. I'm joined now by Sandy Eisenstadt, a professor of modern architecture at the University of Delaware and the author of Electric Light, an Architectural History, which helps us look at light as a building material in itself and the spaces that light has created in our cities. Sandy, thank you for joining us. Let's start with the introduction of lighting into our cities. When did electric lighting first appear and how quickly did it then impact the built environment?
Electric light enters cities really starting in the 1870s. Paris is the first city, most notable city, to illuminate with electric lights after the development of what was called the Yablokov lamp. Russian inventor Pavel Yablokov invented this in 1875. It's essentially a carbon arc lamp, which involves two carbon electrodes and an arc of incredibly bright and incredibly hot electricity between those two arcs. And in a very short time, the technology spread certainly throughout the West. There were tall towers that were built in cities across the United States, for instance. They were called moonlight towers. These were built in the 1880s, and they would have a battery of these arc lamps. They were several thousand candle power in a pretty much a single source. So they were incredibly bright. You would turn the corner behind a building, say, and be plunged into darkness. There are about a dozen of these that still stand in the United States. So cities made different distinctions in terms of their degree to which they were illuminated. As I said, Paris was the first to have sustained electric lighting along the boulevards. London followed suit in 1879. It had lighting in different sections. But there are cities such as Los Angeles in the United States that had light towers in the early 1880s. And people there argued that because Los Angeles had a smaller population than either Paris or New York, it was therefore more brightly illuminated. So there are numerous claims of cities as being the most brightly illuminated city.
Now, of course, when darkness hit prior to widespread lighting, I guess there was gas lighting before electric, but before that, when the end of the day came, people withdrew from the streets often and certainly didn't feel safe to be outside. Once electric light takes off, does this open up a world of entertainment, of the idea that you can be out promenading on a boulevard, as you mentioned? It makes the street a more social space and a place where people of every class are willing to kind of step out after dark.
Yes, it's completely true that urban illumination, first with gas to a significant extent, but also with electric lighting, led to what we can think of as the colonization of the night. As you suggest, before this, you didn't venture out into the night unless you really had cause to do so for a variety of reasons. One was security, but also roads are mostly unpaved, so you could just hurt yourself walking down the street or step in something unpleasant if you didn't have a glance of it at first. So the gaslighting and electric lighting open up the streets to all kinds of social interactions, and certainly with interior lighting, it meant you could do anything that you could do in the day. For instance, when I was renovating a house in Boston that was built in the 1890s, and one of the closets in an attic space I was working on was papered over in newspapers from the period. And as I was pulling it off, I started reading them, and there were advertisements, big advertisements, encouraging homeowners to electrify, with an ad come on that said, "Read at night, install electric lighting." And that's only 120 years ago that it was a novelty to be able to read something at night. So yeah, I think the entire realm of the night was taken over by social activities that were just not practical before that.
And what about the notion of excitement, of consumerism? When we think of the US or here in Europe, whether you walk down to Piccadilly Circus, these were places that celebrated the world of illumination, that there were opportunities for brands to take off in extraordinary ways by using light. We think of the signs atop skyscrapers around the world today. But when light began to come into our cities, did it change the commercial world, the world of entertainment too?
When light enters, and again, it's predominantly gaslight that has this huge effect and then, you know, eclipsed completely by electric light. But commerce itself had a long history of lighting, going back to ancient Rome or even Harappan Indus Valley civilizations, where merchants would have lights out overnight. And, you know, these are just oil lamps typically, or sometimes a torch. And that would be a way to advertise their wares over the night for those brave enough to venture out. But commerce was very quick to pick up on electric lighting. Some of the earliest adopters of electric lighting were the department stores. The great department stores in Paris, like Samaritaine, had opened up at night, and people came just to see the night lighting as much as they did for the purpose of shopping. And as you suggested, electric lighting was associated with a kind of positive energy. And you get certain places, of Brighton's a great example of it, of towns that illuminate and kind of trade quite a bit on that energy. There were even reports on studies that I came across in a journal of psychology that talked about how the mood of any individual would be elevated when they walk into a brightened room, that it would simply have this almost physiological effect on them that could not be resisted. So yes, I think bright lighting and commerce has long been entwined, and only more so with electric lighting. And it's also, as you suggest, the advertising of brands, certainly in places like Piccadilly or Times Square in New York, and the hundreds and hundreds of Times Square-like zones of illuminated commercial speech that have appeared around the world. You can think of the Ginza in Tokyo or other places like that, where part of the point of the district is incredible urban illumination and moving lights and color throughout the night.
Perhaps finally, you could just tell us, are there any things that, as light became commonplace, as cities were illuminated, were there any drawbacks? You've hinted at some of them there, this kind of emotional response, this feeling there's danger as well as promise in light. Were there any other kind of things that you found that were also kind of setbacks in our emotional responses to light?
Yes, there were a number of setbacks registered by people. They might not be seen as setbacks by everyone, but they certainly become prominent at specific times. In the case of the blackouts, there were people who thought that this was a great moment to recover our historic relationship with the night, that it was a temporal zone that we had simply lost touch with. So people were welcoming this idea of the night making its return, even though the circumstances were not the best. Probably the main thing, I think, in terms of a drawback was that electric urban lighting develops as automobiles spread around the world. So much urban lighting is designed for automobiles, and it's quite explicit in the literature in terms of the illuminating engineers that they're trying to develop lighting for an individual moving at 25 miles per hour along a city street. These engineers are looking for continuity of vision at that speed, and the result is relatively unvarying light levels. And that idea gets exported around the world along with automobiles. And it gets exported from cities into countryside. So you get this evenness of lighting really around the world. And the alternative that lighting designers have been looking at really for the last 25 years or so is to think more about pedestrian experience in the city, to focus light on sidewalks rather than road surfaces. So that could be one thing that is a shared experience from a number of different countries, this idea of a kind of uniformity of lighting. And as I said, what's very exciting today is that lighting engineers in cities are starting to recognize they can tailor their lighting schemes to the particularities of their city. And rather than generate a kind of sameness in terms of night lighting from one city to the next, they can actually heighten the unique character of their own cities. And all of that is bolstered by the relatively recent development of new light sources with color profiles that are much closer to natural light, and importantly, all kinds of new control systems and sensors that can infer the conditions in particular settings at particular moments and adjust the lighting. So it's a sort of golden age for urban lighting today.
Well, Sandy, no surprise, it was a very illuminating conversation. Who's Higgins, you know so much about the world of light. And great, because you've got, I think, all of our listeners thinking about things that they've probably never contemplated before when they've looked at the world of light and of beams. So thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for also, it's spring, and it was very nice to hear the odd songbird in the background as well. So I'm not sure if you're by an open window, but great to speak to you. Thank you, Sandy. Lenny Schwendinger is an urban lighting and nighttime designer. She has over 20 years of experience helping planners, architects and city leaders create better illuminated urban environments around the world. As the creative director of the International Nighttime Design Initiative, one of her particular areas of focus is what happens after the sun sets and how to use the city's darkened hours better. So I'm pleased to say that Lenny joins me now from New York. Lenny, thanks for joining us on The Urbanist. Now, nighttime design is a relatively new concept, albeit a very important one. Can you start by telling us what nighttime design actually is then, and what kinds of problems it seeks to address?
Well, you know, I am an urban lighting designer, but I found that that is too narrow a category for what we face in the world's urbanizing spaces, the cities that are growing without electricity, with electricity, with and without lighting, and that it's bigger than lighting. So we look at night as place. So night is a place distinct from day. And how we design as urban designers, architects, lighting designers, security designers, infrastructure designers, mobility experts, how we design for the night has got to be different than the day. So actually, to be successful in the practice of nighttime design, we have to start with safety. We have to start with the known. And what I try to do is build the idea of atmosphere, perception, and belonging. So I'm moving my municipal employee and leader towards thinking about scenarios and atmospheres and people on the ground, how we feel welcome, how we feel happy, and how we feel safe. Now, there are some interesting studies, just to say, in terms of crime and women, for example, being accosted, more light is not necessarily better light.
And is this for people who they have no choice, that they have to be out on the streets because their work demands it? And also people who are out for pleasure and leisure at night, because the nighttime is a whole economy that people want to participate in as well in good times. So are you there facing a dilemma because you're designing for two scenarios, one where actually light should be less intrusive, perhaps more beautiful, perhaps designed for enhancing buildings and enhancing streetscapes, and another, as you said, where there is more of a kind of a safety element involved as well?
That is such a great question. We have identified those two populations as a big cut. Those of us who must be out and those of us who love to be out at night. And often those two do not meet in terms of perception. So let's just look at that. For the people who must be out at night, who are traversing by bus, by bike, by car, by foot, let us open up the idea of lighting to places of respite, benches with light, a shelter with light. Let's have the breadcrumbs of light along the way to the job. And for the people who are having a great time, maybe those essential workers on the weekend, let's say, who are going out to theater, who are walking in the public square, let us find ways, and this is community engagement, getting community associations, tenant associations, housing estates, plus the stakeholders, the owners, the government, bringing the right people to the workshops to begin to program light at night.
And tell me, when you do those workshops, you know, we're seeing urbanists and urban designers trying to be more participatory, allowing people to have their voices heard. Here you're talking about something which already begins to sound quite complicated. You have these very different communities using night in different ways. But were there some universal things that came forward as you began to speak to men and women, of course, who use the night for their jobs and for getting around? Were there some things that came forward that fed into your design solutions?
Well, exactly. You know, I have to say that one universal through the workshops is a place to meet. And that's why I mentioned the benches. Unusually so, even in a workshop at Bogota. In Bogota, number one was save the historic fabric. And this is nighttime design, right? So it's not just lighting. The second one was a place to meet. The third objective, because we often look for three objectives, was soft light. So these are universals, although I must say it changes by culture. So color temperature, which is sort of, is it cool or is it warm light? You know, my understanding, and this is a vast generalization, is that perhaps in Asia, cool light is more welcoming and more preferred. Whereas here in the US, you will get a resounding chorus for warm light. So that is why we do pilots. Pilots will engage people in their perceptions, their opinions, with a little bit of education beforehand, a better vocabulary. We can engage people and their sensibilities and perceptions to come up with good lighting solutions. The built environment, as you know, is very specific per neighborhood. So why not the lighting?
Another big question about darkness is, if you don't have enough light, you can feel a bit isolated, you can feel a bit lonely, you can feel a bit cut off. Is there a kind of a mental health story here as well, in the way that you provide light? Not just you make people feel safe, but you make people feel better and good about themselves if there is adequate lighting.
Well, this is a great question, and I'm very much a mental health proponent through lighting, in the sense that when we talk about health and walkability, as we often do, we're extending the hours of walkability. That's an important issue. So if people can extend the hours of exercise and walking after sort of the 9 to 5 hours of work into the night, that is the good thing, and lighting will help that. On the other side of the health coin, we have mental health. So sociability, going on a walk with families and friends, is extremely important, and there's a lot of writing on that. I also think that sparkle and accent of private light, okay, so going beyond street lighting or adding to street light poles, some sparkle and color makes a big difference in our focus and attention and enjoyment of walking at night.
A contradictory thing, which is, again, getting lots of press here in the UK as we speak to you this week, is there's been a report saying that because of the lockdown, many buildings haven't been so well lit at night and lots of lights have been turned off. So suddenly you can see more of the stars and there's less what they call light pollution. So on the other side, there's been a push this week here in many of the headlines saying we need to turn off more lights at night, not have more. How do you balance all these things, the demand for less light pollution, for using less energy at night, and also the need for greater lighting to make us enjoy our spaces?
You've hit on one of the great controversies. Earlier, we discussed the types of people who are out at night, the typologies, the users, those of us who love to be out, those of us who must be out. Now we are discussing the nature and the social life of people on the ground. This is a giant challenge for lighting designers. I think it's important to understand the realities of energy use, hugely important. The realities of blocking the biorhythms of nature, whether it's plants or insects or birds. The awe that we have looking up into the sky when we can see the stars with our lives in cities. And there are cities beyond London. There are cities that are slums. There are informal settlements where safety, welcome, the ability to simply be a female and get out of the house might be more important than seeing the stars. So that's extreme, perhaps, but I think that both issues need to be taken into account and applied as needed, applied as prioritized in each city.
That was the nighttime designer, Leni Schwendinger. Thank you for joining us here on The Urbanist. So perhaps we've been focusing here on very developed cities, but we should also think about lighting in informal settlements where it's super important for allowing people to get around safely and securely. I'm joined now by Stephanie Bryers from ETH Zurich's Institute of Science, Technology and Policy, whose research focuses on public lighting in these informal settlements. Stephanie has a particular focus on South Africa, where she's been working on a project to test lighting solutions in the informal settlement of Khayelitsha. Stephanie, thank you for speaking to us here on The Urbanist. Now, Khayelitsha is an enormous informal settlement in Cape Town that we've looked at before here on the show. What we haven't looked at, however, is the lighting situation there. Tell me, what is the lighting landscape right now? And what are the drawbacks when trying to make lighting more widespread in a place like this?
Khayelitsha has a long and a complicated history. It's known as a township, and in South Africa, townships are defined mainly as places that were designed for Black African people to live in during apartheid. And within this township environment, there are what we refer to as pocket informal settlements, which are basically informal settlements that develop in open spaces that were supposedly designated for schools or maybe public open spaces. And so these informal settlements are specifically where I'm working. But Khayelitsha's lighting situation in general consists of high mast lighting, which is very tall, 40 meter high floodlights, that was implemented during apartheid. In the late apartheid years, around 1984 to 1985, they started implementing these lights throughout townships in South Africa. And so the current lighting situation is still the same in Black African townships in South Africa and also in Khayelitsha, where you'd find these very, very tall, yellow kind of sodium vapor floodlights. It almost kind of demarcates the township. So you can really see from an aerial view when you're flying at night, for example, you can really see where these townships are. And within that, there are some streetlights, but those streetlights are only on the main arterial roads, and the rest of the neighborhood would still try and make use of these tall floodlights, which aren't very efficient at all.
And what's the impact of lighting a township like that? So, as you say, you have this kind of floodlight almost light at night. But does that make people feel comfortable going out at night to step out of their front doors? Does it make women feel more secure having such strong lighting, or does it have the opposite effect?
That's a difficult thing to answer, and that, I guess, is why I've been struggling so much for 4 years with my research, is when one asks people living in informal settlements and townships whether they like these tall lights and whether these tall lights make them feel safe and comfortable, the general answer is yes. But then they say, but there aren't enough of them and we want more and we want them closer to our houses. But this is a complicated question, because if you really assess these lights versus street lights, you'll find that these tall lights seem like they're far away, and they seem like that if there were to be more, then things would be better. But actually, what the real situation is, that these lights cast very dark, deep shadows, especially in informal settlements where pathways are very narrow. And so the lighting situation is very bad. And when you ask people, they normally say, yes, they're happy with these lights, but they just want more of them. And so women generally also don't feel safe outside at night at all. They're very, very fearful. And most of the time, the reason why they say they don't feel safe at night when related to lighting is because they cannot recognize people's faces and they cannot see who is approaching them from far away.
I presume there are many services that people have to leave their homes for even at night. So in many informal settlements, and I don't know what the situation here is in Qalisha, but you would have to go out to collect water, for example, often a communal toilet, for example, or a place to get food because you can't store it in your home very easily. These would all be reasons that people would actually have to leave their homes after dark. Is that the situation here, or are actually people more staying within their homes at night?
Absolutely. People do have shared public services in informal settlements generally, and these are often located in kind of centralized positions and also sometimes located on the periphery of an informal settlement because it makes it easier for service trucks to access. And so things like toilets are almost inaccessible at night. Some people do access them at night, but this comes at a huge fear and risk associated to accessing these places at nighttime. So as a result, there's some quite onerous coping mechanisms that have developed. One, for example, is the bucket system, where people have to use buckets inside their homes as toilets at night and empty them out during the day. The second thing is that people also have to commute very far to work and back. So Khayelitsha is located quite far outside of Cape Town, and commuting times, also due to very heavy traffic, can last up to 2 hours a day going there and back. So what you have is people waking up very early in the morning, walking in the dark to their public transport, and coming home at night after dark. So the only time that they're actually getting to experience their home and their neighborhood is after dark, which makes public lighting so important.
Now, you're doing all this research. Is your hope that you might be able to come forward with some ideas about making the lighting situation better? Because the description you give almost makes it sound like prison floodlights, you know, that you could have lighting that's more functional, that allows people to feel comfortable about leaving their homes, but which is a little bit more friendly as well.
Absolutely. So my research is actually an applied research project where I'm working with a colleague of mine. She's a development economist, and we're implementing a wall-mounted solar lighting solution, and we've already finished the first phase. And what we've done is, instead of having centralized infrastructure like the high masts, we have one light per household. So each household gets their own wall-mounted floodlight above their front door or close to their front door. And these little lights basically shine straight into the very narrow pathways, which would normally be cast in dark shadow. And the other idea with this infrastructure is also that we start to blur the boundaries between public infrastructure and private ownership, where the household actually takes a sense of ownership over the light and therefore would hopefully take better care of the light and report any problems that they have with the light, for example, which is currently not happening with high mast lights. People don't feel any sense of ownership. So if there are maintenance issues, reporting is really poor.
And Stephanie, tell me, in the places where you've seen these lights introduced, has that been the impact? What kinds of changes have you seen happen?
So I've just come back from South Africa to do some end-line field work, and so far so good. The results have been quite positive, and in my interviews, the main result and the main thing that people have mentioned that these lights do is they allow for people to be able to recognize somebody, and this makes them feel kind of safer because they are able to, should something happen, they're able to go to the police and report whether it's a case of theft or gender-based violence. They can then go and report this case to the police, whereas previously, when it's so dark, you kind of feel hopeless because if you get abused or attacked in the dark, you aren't able to even recognize the person and file an appropriate report. So that was quite positive. The other thing that people mentioned is that they're starting to sit outside at night, especially at the moment. South Africa has quite a bad spout of load shedding, which is planned power outages. And these often happen around 8 to 10 at night, where actually you're coming home from work and you're cooking dinner and you're eating dinner with your family. And what's happened is people are now starting to venture outside and sit outside their front doors underneath the solar lamp to take some time with their families and enjoy the evening with their neighbors even. So that's quite a positive outcome.
Well, Stephanie, amazing work you're doing, and thank you for joining us on the show to tell us all about it. That was Stephanie Briers from ETH Zurich's Institute of Science, Technology and Policy. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Rabello and David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's The Smiths with There Is a Light That Never Goes Out. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.